Welcome to our next installment of the Mission Market and Margin Podcast. I'm Rick Stasloff, founder and senior partner with RPK Group, and I'm joined today by Dr. Cynthia Tiniente-Madsen. Cynthia is the president of Texas A&M University San Antonio. Cynthia, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. Now, Cynthia, we first met through RPK's work at AskU, and we've really enjoyed working with that organization and the kind of institutions like your own that they serve. I know you are currently the chair-elect for AskU.
Correct. And, you know, it's a really interesting time, you know, much like we're going to be talking about today, it's about business case and re-examining our purpose. And that really was the engagement that AskU had with RPK in re-looking at our business model and how we were delivering services. So it's great to see that this is kind of thinking is occurring in every sector of our community. So I'm delighted to be here with you today.
Well, thanks. And I know you were an important part of that. It is interesting, isn't it, that higher ed's going through its moment of who do we serve, how, and the institutions, organizations that serve higher ed are going through that same moment. I think the foundation community is trying to figure out, oh, now how do we best serve institutions and figure out best practice? So it's an important time to take a step back, reflect, but also then move back towards action. So some tension points there. Well, interesting tension point. Our topic today is the return on investment from student success. When I think throughout the 10, 11 years with RPK now, you know, you always see the passion from faculty and staff, right? Around mission, around student success, and that needs to be there. But how do we create sustainability is something on my mind in terms of what you just mentioned, Cynthia, in terms of that business model, so we can keep reinvesting in mission, so we can keep reinvesting in student success. And one of the ahas I've had in the last decade is that what's good for student success actually turns out to be good for the business model. So how do we connect those dots? So we'll explore that in a couple different ways then in our time together. So, you know, Cynthia, I've often said that I've been a fan of yours from the outset because you're one of the few senior leaders to move from the chief financial officer role into the presidency. So can you talk about your CFO lens and how that's helped shape your time in the president's chair?
Well, absolutely. I think CFOs, business officers tend to have the understanding of a broad institutional knowledge and institutional culture. And for me, the focus on sustainability has been from day one. That's sort of the you know, the core basic hygiene of being a CFO, so to speak. And so I think a lot about for us at A&M San Antonio as a startup institution. We're in our 12th year. We started off as a system center of A&M Kingsville in the very prominent A&M system here in Texas. And so we have been building somewhat with startup funds, as well as some base dollars that are appropriated to us through the state business model and tuition and revenue and such. So to keep growth and acceleration and to get to basically a critical mass where you can self-sustain, every day the focus is on institutional sustainability. So my role, my background and understanding about that is really helpful. Now let me tell you, as a president or CEO, you know, I'm not tinkering with the GL. I'm not monkeying with the balance sheet. I mean, but I understand when the numbers come to me, what they mean, what the levers are, what's going to move the needle. And it is complicated at this level because you're, as a CEO, you're actually very far removed from a lot of operational elements. And so that knowledge for me has served me well. I also think as a CFO, the other piece that has served me well is a real understanding of real estate, land development, land acquisition, you know, P3s, auxiliary operations, and how to be creative in finding and diversifying the revenue, maintaining the diversified revenue, but also building up our assets and building up our acquisitions and partnerships as we move forward. So those are two big things. And I think the third thing that I would say that's really important for successful CBOs is the intricate knowledge and importance, sometimes nuance, of consultation and campus engagement. And so it's easy as a CEO to want to go, to need to go fast. and to be reminded that it is about process, it is about consultation and engagement and bringing people along with you with this wealth of knowledge. I think that's probably true in many seats, but I found it particularly true in the CBO lane because you're sort of in a different category of how the academics view you.
Totally. I love this. You know, it speaks so much to, I think, this need on two levels. One is around strategic CFOs, you know, that you can nail the numbers, right? But if you can't create meaning, be a good storyteller, understand change management, get into the sustainability mode, I think it's almost impossible to really be fully successful as a CFO. You, of course, are pulling these great skills up into the presidency now in terms of how you weave that into a whole new basket of needs in order to lead the institution forward. It's really interesting, though, that you talk about the institution as a startup still. And that's an interesting place to be in and a rather privileged position, meaning not everybody gets that chance to help create something.
That is so true. And it's, you know, what else is really important that I have come to understand? You know, we talk about like the elephants in the room, or what is the other, the purple cow, those types of things. What you can see as a startup organization is how easy it is to bake those habits. Yes. Into a culture, as opposed to being knowledgeable about it and making sure we're not baking something into the DNA that we can never unwind, or it'll take a long time to unwind. And so I do think about that in terms of the talent that is in various levels of the organization and how they're thinking about processes and engagement that's cross-functional to make sure we can try to eliminate or at least minimize some of those things that later become silos, or, you know, how did this happen where you know, we need 16 signatures for something? Those types of opportunities we have a chance to see. And so at the cabinet level, we really try to avoid some of that over-processing where we can, but it really does require sort of top-down direction as well as bottom-up understanding of doing the right thing.
Well, that's a great segue. You know, I was thinking about, we want to talk about return on investment. We want to talk about the business model. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners would think, oh, this is going to be about just the numbers, right? Hey, I'm a numbers guy, you know, from way back when. But I know for us to be successful with good data and analysis, you've got to touch on culture, which is what you've just been speaking to. So give me some examples then. You know, you've clearly been focusing on this. What's been working in terms of making sure you create a culture at San Antonio that avoids siloing, that avoids those kind of obstacles that get in everybody's way in doing their job? What's been working?
Well, I don't think anybody has all the right answers. What I can say to you that even at a smaller institution that's building up, has a lot of energy, it happens. And so it seeps in. It just seeps in. And so how I think about this, especially now through the pandemic, is so what I call the new F word. And the new F word is flexibility. And as we think about the culture, to your point about ROI, one of the things we've learned through the pandemic, and then we saw it again also here in Texas through the freeze that happened in February, February, when the whole state, was down and all of our systems and all of our backup systems failed, is the importance of what is our mission? What is our purpose? And I think all of us at every level, Rick, whether it's at the individual level, am I in the right job? Is this what I want to do with my life?
Right.
To the higher level, you know, does the university really following its mission and serving and supporting students in the way that that need to happen? In our case, we're a Hispanic serving institution. We received the designation shortly after we were born. So I use the phrase that we were born in HSI, even though we didn't get the designation till later. We've always been, you know, well over 70%. In earlier days, it was even higher, a Hispanic serving institution in terms of how students self-identify. And primarily first generation, primarily low income. And so we, and in terms of mission and ROI, our university was founded in an area that has been long on list for income segregation, generations worth of challenges that can date back to redlining, poverty, these under-resourced areas. So having a public university here in the center of that, there's a lot of hope and inspiration that exists just by having sort of no expense spared by the A&M system to be here in this region that we serve. And so when you think about ROI for us and culture, it's really understanding the most affirmative lens possible for the opportunities that are available for the students that attend and come to A&M San Antonio. And we have to know and understand equity, and we have to know and understand disparity, and know and understand how do we create that leveling so that students can be successful, change their household income, break those cycles, and actually seed in many cases the college-going culture in their own families and homes. So that ROI for me at our university is much greater than just the student graduating and he or she or they themselves changing their income trajectory. As we know, you know, over $1 million over your lifetime, et cetera. Our university also has to change the community in which we were founded and born to serve. So we're also an anchor for economic development, innovation, research, all of these aspirations that great public universities and great public research universities have. So I know this is a long-winded answer, but the ROI really is woven in so many levels, especially when you're focused on mission and culture. And it's hard. None of this work is easy. It's expensive. It takes more time. Thoughtfulness to understand. I think there's a lot of literature written about what works for communities of color, first generation, all of those. And you just layer all of those elements on then trying to build a university.
I like something that you're lifting up, you know, that I've often spoken about, which is ROI doesn't just mean one thing, right? You know, there is certainly the ROI is the bottom line. We all know that. We're afraid of that sometimes in higher ed, or that we think that's all it means. But your great point around ROI for, yes, student completion, but for how you're impacting their families, what you're doing within the community, you know, that ROI is a little bit different at different levels, different parts of the whole ecosystem, I guess, that you're serving, and how you just have to be really intentional about it. You can't just say that once and assume it's going to happen. Right. But you've got to keep coming back and grounding to that.
I think I use the frame. You have to always create the line of sight because it's really easy, especially because people are busy. In general, outside pandemic, people are just busy. I think gone were the days that people just, you know, sat at their desk waiting for the phone to ring or something like that. I mean, that just doesn't occur. And so you want to make sure that you're always connecting how each role in the organization is actually moving the needle. And that comes through data collection, which is also hard. You know, the big, I think some of the confrontations we've had now with understanding the data that we need to understand what is the impact of the pandemic on students now.
Right.
So that has made this much more complicated. Some more mature organizations have a better handle on all of their data. We certainly don't. We're building up, and we have lots of data. We know how to get at it, but to get at it quickly and then to make sense of, well, what is the pandemic impact on this? And why is the pandemic impact on that? Requires us asking a lot of questions. I'll give you an example from December of 20, coming into January of 21, we had about 900 students that didn't re-enroll. So that's kind of an easy number to get, right? Most data systems capture persistence from one semester to another, or retention. But when we then started, well, who are they? Why didn't they come back? Well, it turns out that some unusually high number, I'm not going to remember exactly, but let's say a third, around a third, were actually seniors with less than like 10 credits or so to graduate, and were not on academic hold and didn't have a financial hold. So what do you do with that? Like, it's like, oh, wow. So all of your retention strategies that are focused on freshmen or sophomore, right, the sophomore slump, all these other things, doesn't even really make sense. So we began the phone calling campaign, the emailing, the whatever, how we communicate with student, instant messaging, text messaging, social media, et cetera. And it's simply just fatigue. I'm overwhelmed. I'm homeschooling my children or whatever the case may be. I'm helping with elder care. So the data piece is really critical in helping to understand that, but then what do you do with it and how do you continue to remain cutting edge and how do you track all of those variables? What we have seen, and I think many institutions have seen this, is our biggest dip in enrollment for this fall now, fall of 21, is in continuing students. And I think that's happening in a lot of places. Our freshman classes are up, our freshman cohorts are up, our transfer students are up, our graduate students in our particular case have been leveling off for some other structural issues that we're fixing. But the continuing students, I've heard consistently amongst many of my colleagues, has been the place where there's the big dip. So all of this to say, the importance of how then you create the system so you can nimbly capture this, because some of this now we have to tease out manually. So right, you're running one-off reports, one-off systems, one-off analyses in scenarios like that, and just makes it tougher.
Yeah, I think a lot of this speaks to this whole idea of data-informed culture, right? We talked about culture,
yes,
data, bringing that together. And I think data-informed culture is really a new idea in much of higher ed in terms of, stop, data, yes, but what does this mean? And what would we really do about it? And what does good look like so we can hold ourselves accountable, right? Repeat, and at all levels of the organization.
Right.
I think we're just starting to kind of get our skill set up around that at all levels. Do you see that?
Yes, I think the data literacy question, remains unanswered, because this cannot just come from the top. Sort of the Peter Senge five whys. Why is that? And why is that? And why is that? For every answer, what is the response? I think it's overwhelming because people on the front lines, we also saw, for example, in that sort of same exemplar, the 900 students that some high percentage of freshman students hadn't re-enrolled from one semester to the next semester. Those things, we have warnings. We have some more early warning alerts because we capture some of that data earlier, but the patterns are just outside the norm. And so you're then asking, advisors and counselors and the Student Success Center, okay, why? What do we do about that? How do we fix it? We can't have everybody on the sidelines. So what are some things that we need to do operationally different to help bridge those gaps? And so I think the data literacy story is still being written, is still being built, and the training and the complexity of the training is tough. At our campus, as part of our SAC COC, we have our QEP, our quality enhancement plan, is around quantitative reasoning, QR. And we try to embed some of these questions into the teaching and learning environment, as well as the administrative environment. So like I said earlier, where you can sort of thread the needle and weave these things together, so you're using the same term. This is why you're doing this. This is what quantitative reasoning looks like. Right. This is how data literacy helps you move the needle towards logic, analysis, logic, conclusions. And those are all can be part of that learning narrative, not only for students, but for faculty and staff too.
So you're really investing then in capacity building. And that's a long-term strategy to address some long-term challenges, quite frankly, in higher ed. A lot of the things I think you're wrestling with, we are throughout the industry, they've been around for a while. And sometimes I think we try to bring short-term solutions to long-term issues. When I think about HERF, for instance, federal government for your largesse and recognizing the value that our institutions bring. As I look across institutions nationally, though, I see that probably the biggest use of this from the institutional fund perspective is closing some of those gaps from a revenue perspective. Now, totally allowable and an important use of HERF funds. But we've been trying to work with institutions around how do you make investments in the long term now, not just to sort of fill holes for what happened over the last year. What are you seeing in terms of maybe what the opportunity is right now as some of those federal funds become available?
Well, I can tell you from my perspective, again, at a Hispanic serving institution, and as I mentioned, in an area that's surrounded by high levels of poverty, our goal is in 5 years that we're looking backwards at digital equity, that we're looking backwards at access, we're looking backwards at digital literacy. You know, one of the things we learned through the pandemic, and we could use HERF money for this, to give students laptops or give students hotspots or give students a camera, whatever it was that they needed. And that was actually the easiest part. You know, acquiring the equipment, you know, putting a serial number on it and distributing it to a student is actually the easiest part. Right. But the students themselves knowing how to learn in that way really added to their stress levels is what we found in a largely first generation community. So between March of 2020, when the pandemic hit, and then what we did for fall of 2020, we actually put in place a digital help desk that was run by students. So we invested in the training, the infrastructure, and really looked backwards at, okay, what do we assume that people know, but maybe they really don't know? And those people were our own students. And so when they came to pick up the laptops that in fall, they had to sit with someone. They didn't just get it handed to them. Okay, so let's log on. Let's make sure your credentials work. Let's make sure you can get into Blackboard. Make sure you can get into JagSync and the other programs that we use here. And then, you know, can you really use Word? Do you know how to use Excel? Do you know how to upload those documents? And what seemed so simple was some of the areas that you're looking at, and again, brought to us this issue of equity. And what we assume students know in general, they really didn't know. And with HERF money and some donor funded money, we've actually lifted that to a whole nother level with an actual digital literacy program that was much more organized and orchestrated. So, you know, you can only do so much at scale when somebody's got to sit with you, right, and open the computer and make sure you know something. And so now we have courses and workshops. And what we've done on this, and I will say that I think this is truly a national model. At A&M San Antonio, thinking back to what we said about sustainability and ROI, we have a very deep partnership and connection, and I would say co-responsibility for some of the school districts. There's 15 school districts or so in Bexar County where I'm located. We have a partnership with 7 of them. Wow. And we actually, we call it the Aspire Network. It's an acronym for Strategic Partnerships Impacting Regional Equity and Excellence. But to this point, those schools were worse than we were. And those are the same students that are going to be coming to us. So through a third-party funder, we created a digital help desk model where middle schoolers can take these workshops, displaced workers could take the workshops, and they could become the operators of a digital help desk for the ISDs and under our student model that we had for our university digital help desk. So you've got this layering going on between campus IT, the school district IT, and students in the classroom and how they nest that back in their homes, which really is going to have a much longer ROI and I think a much greater leverage of these HERF investments.
And for you, you're investing in the community from a mission perspective, but you're also in many ways supporting your business model because you're investing in your future students. So they'll be better prepared, ready to engage in the very services that you offer. So that's a win-win-win-win-win-win-win, probably add it all up.
When we put in either federal requests for federal funding or donor funds, we get almost a perfect score because all the districts are aligned. We've added to this now parent engagement, parent training, bilingual training. And, you know, a lot of displaced workers. And so we talked earlier, I think you mentioned something about workforce development,
right.
Individuals, you know, a lot of what we see, what we have seen in terms of that job market also really disproportionately impacted a university community like mine, because so many of our students live at home with their parents who are working multiple jobs, or they themselves are working multiple jobs. So the ability to use displaced workers in these digital help desk models is really fruitful, because what we discovered is that many individuals are reading at the eighth grade level, displaced workers, that is, where they have a high school credential. And you can just imagine the poverty gap that will create, that cannot be easily eradicated. And so I'm hopeful that these types of initiatives and programs, and why I'm so invested in them, will have a return on investment back for our institution. And it's the role of a public university if we're really going to be stewards of place.
No question. I'm not sure that everyone looks at it that way, though. So my hat's off to you in that it's a pretty bold rethinking around that important question of what's our job, right? My observation, you know, I'm in my fourth decade of higher ed now, is often we're more inwardly focused. What do we want to do? What do we want to offer to you, the student, the community? We don't stop and say, what's the need out there? What's the demand out there? How do we respond to that? Especially as it's shifting over time. So you're really changing, I think, the job that you're giving the institution, not just you, but you know, all of you are giving yourselves, and how you have to respond.
Well, that is part of the big idea where we do these elements. And what I say to our community is partially what you said, is we're making these investments because we will reap the benefits of them. Mm-hmm. And that part of our job about economic development is to change this narrative and have our teachers, students that we graduate into the teaching profession, go to a school district where they will stay and retain, and they can't if they're all challenged with this systemic. And I think we're going to see this, Rick, in minority communities, minority males that are really being left behind. Anecdotally, what some of the data shows, the lots of students that are just in the middle that are not going to be found, that didn't go anywhere after high school and didn't go to college, and maybe they're in the workforce. This is going to hurt our long-term economic recovery if we don't find these, you know, opportunity youth, basically, and help to bridge that gap.
So I get asked a lot, I bet you do too, you know, as people get on board with the very things you're sharing here, I'm sure they've said, like, Cynthia, how do I do it? You know, like where do I start? And so I think that covers a couple different things, right? One is, to what extent do you see that what you're sharing in terms of the job you've given yourself, does it redefine the roles deeply in the organization? Like, what does it mean to be a dean or a chair, a faculty member, a staff member, if you're going to go towards that kind of community impact that you're describing?
Well, you know, the way I see it, the deans, I see the most impact on a dean in the College of Education, for example, that because they're a big part of the work we do with the schools. They are the work we do with the schools. So it's very much integrated into the College of Education. Their curriculum development, they work directly with the superintendents. We have faculty in residence in the schools. In some cases, Rick, this is kind of really wild. We actually run the schools through a model here called, it's an in-district partnership, in essence what it is, but it's governed through a special Senate bill here that allows the university, the university and the district have to agree on it. So we actually created a separate 501c3 it's called the Institute for School and Community Partnerships, and that's where we park schools that we run. So we have this partnership with the 7 school districts. We look for collective impact. We're building curriculum around what they need. We've offered new degrees based on what the superintendents say they need and want. And we're building the not only the curriculum, but the experiential learning, the practicum, the year-long credentialing, all around that. And a lot of that garners donor support because it's the university and the district partnering together. But when we actually run schools, Then we have a faculty in residence. We have year-long students in the credentialing process. We have graduate students, and their coursework from the graduate faculty is based on the schools and in the schools. And so it really shifts that narrative, but it is tied directly to our instruction and student credit hour production. So when you ask me about the deans, I would say it's most directly impacted in the College of Education. But for business and arts and sciences and some of the other subject matter experts too, they still obviously have the responsibility to build up the programs, and their community engagement is in the communities that we serve. It doesn't have to be in the schools. It can be in the businesses. As long as those, the nonprofits that are in the area, and there's a lot of them, through another funder, a lot of our nonprofit internships have funding from third-party providers, because a first-generation student can't afford to do an internship for no pay. They just can't, or reduced pay. Right. So they can compete for stipends and all these other things. So this notion of experiential learning is really the big piece that I would say is embedded in what the deans are doing and how they're doing it, and how we practice community and civic engagement on the fundamental things like voting. We know that communities of color and there's a lot being discussed about Texas and voting laws. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about students even understanding why they should vote, why they should be registered, how important it is, and then engaging the whole community around that. So we try to deeply embed it, but it's to your initial question, it's around your strategic plan. Mm. And these elements are baked into our strategic plan. It's baked into our mission. It's baked into our vision, and our goals, objectives, and action plans connect these pieces together. That doesn't mean that all that we do is just in South Bear County. It's not. We have connections all over. But whatever we're doing all over needs to be helping lift the university, which lifts the community.
So let's say that I'm a brand new president and I'm on board with everything you're describing. And I call you and say, Cynthia, what should I do? Where do I start? What would you say?
I would say, know your base, know your culture. I mean, really think strategically, understand what your boss wants, whether that's the chancellor or the board, depending on what kind of system and structure you're in, and make sure that they agree with what you're trying to accomplish. Because it's going to take your resources and your efforts to make that happen. And it's always about the storytelling and the narrative. Engage your elected officials if you're at a public university so that you understand what they want to have happen, as well as what you're trying to make happen. One of the things that I did that was really telling for me, and I actually didn't do it till probably the second year, I actually hired a consultant, a statewide group, to come and do an assessment on the state of South Bear County education, because there's lots of places that collect data, but there was no one place that would tell the narrative. So a lot of it's aggregated data. I had to have it disaggregated by ISD and then clustered by a cluster of ISDs in this region and territory. Mm-hmm. And that was a third party validated document that could help me say, hey, look, in these 10 zip codes, less than 50% of people have a high school degree, or whatever the case may be,
right.
or they've taken some credits and they dropped out. So these sorts of things work wonderfully when you take it to an elected official. So here's the problem, and here's how I think I can help you, but this is what I need from you. Or same with a donor, and getting really understanding the politics, especially the first few years. It's about ensuring that you're keeping everybody happy, all of your base happy, and then being tenacious if that's really what you think you ought to achieve.
Good. Well, no small thing. And I think that brings us to the end of our conversation. I love that we've moved from data, yes, into meaning making, but then touching on how do you drive towards action in the way that really requires a rethinking of the job we give ourselves and ultimately the culture at our own institution. So something I can see you've invested very deeply in. I want to thank you all for joining us for this session of the Mission Market and Margin podcast. I especially want to thank our guest today. Cynthia, thanks for joining us and sharing so candidly from your experience. I know it's going to benefit all of our listeners.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to see you. Have a great rest of the day.
I will. Wherever you're listening or watching from, everybody, please stay safe and healthy in the present moment as you care for your students, your faculty, and the staff. I hope you're having wonderful, successful starts to your fall semester. Keep doing what you're doing. Higher Ed needs you.